It is the four emotions, the four types of four worldly ideals, which are peace, prosperity, peace, seduction, and wrath. Those are the four powers that we all try for one way or the other. Wouldn't you say that's true? Prosperity, don't you like having something to eat once in a while in the day? How many of you do not like something to eat once in a while in the day, but are forced to anyway? I don't care. Anorexics are allowed to have it for two. Anybody else? Just me, eh? Okay, I'm the only one who likes prosperity. Oh, you do. You like having a place to live, could I see a show of hands here? And you like having food, do you? Hi. You like having food? Everybody likes having food, do they? Is that true? And nice to have a roof over your head and clothes and things like that. Is that right? You all agree with that? Right, so we're all agreed that we like prosperity. So that's the front, you know. That's like first. And you like to have a body that seems to be working fairly well, you know, and handling earth quite well, right? And when you really have that really well and you notice other people that don't, or you notice that it could disappear, do you get kind of tight about it and not want to see three people? Or of course Hobart doesn't have three people, so what am I talking about here? I know this is actually heaven itself here, but say pretend like you went to some, you know, really sin city, kind of like Melbourne or, you know, like Sydney or someplace like that where like, you know, ugh, there they were, all these street, you know, let's say New York City, oh God, where they were like everywhere about to assault your eyes, people who don't have. Because you know how much we can wall off? You see, you have something, you're comfortable with it, and you see somebody who doesn't have, you kind of just have an excuse you don't see. Anybody ever done that in their life? Ah, good, I'm not the only one this time either. Excellent. Oh, you never have, eh? Oh, God, Just checking to see if you all understand properly, because you all have exactly the same things you're working with as I do. That's called pride. Pride comes in three flavors. Did you know that? One is, I'm better than. Because you don't want to look at the fact that you might have to share what you've got, because you feel kind of uncomfortable, you know, about having that, but you really do want it, and you're not sure if you give it away whether you will have it, make sense, or whether they will use it well, so it's better to think, well, I probably deserve it. And you hear people say, why don't they get a job? How come they don't just go out? You know, sometimes there's some truth in that, but they're not, it's not being said with kindness. It's being said with, I earned it. With pride, with like clinging to, as if the universe will always give you exactly what you need. Which it will, but you won't always recognize it as what you need. So when you recognize that, oh yeah, I deserve this, it's fine, but when you get, you know, cancer or, you know, a little brain tumor, something that changes your point of view, you notice that. Or an accident, or like a little wrinkle in the complexion of your life occurs, and suddenly it's very confusing, isn't it? Because you've identified with a certain way of being yourself, a certain style, a certain habit. We don't like to look at the great, 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 wonderful guru of despair and unhappiness. We don't like to. We don't like to welcome that one in our home, do we? So that first kind of pride that we get into is like, I am better than. And that one is rampant in our society, don't you think? I mean, look at the commercial. Your breath is always supposed to be a certain, you know. Every orifice of your body has its particular smell that you're supposed to be working with at all times. You see, like armpits and so forth. I won't go further. I'm sure you understand totally. There's like this sense that we're supposed to be appearing always as if we were something that never was ill, never died, never experienced despair, aren't we? There's that kind of, not so much in Hobart, which is one of the things I love about coming here. It's like I actually get to just be a person, you know, which I do anyway, but here it's more acceptable. And the second kind of conceit is where you do you know anybody who is really dedicated to never having any money or never having enough time, or like yourself or somebody like that? Yeah. So that's a conceit too. It's like I have a dear friend who was Irish Catholic from the Maritimes, which means raised in poverty, basically. And the whole concept that my friend worked with all the time she was growing up was what Irish Catholics in the Maritimes lived with. Well, it's all right for them because they have money. But we are just doing our best and we can't, you know. So the kind of way when you actually got a job, what you did was you blew, you saved your money all year and then you blew it on a 2.5 week holiday in Hawaii, and then you spent 6 months paying for that, and then 6 months collecting the money. You understand? Because what was important was to be able to see how they lived every once in a while, so you could hold it really clear that that wasn't what you were doing. Am I making sense? Any of you can identify that? Where like there are things that you don't do because it's all right for them, but some of us have to. Whatever it is. And do you see how that view stops you from seeing self and other as being working with the same thing? Like you get a little kind of hard edge. And then the third kind of conceit is called equality. I don't know if any of you have ever had this experience, but sometimes you're talking to somebody and you're telling them about seeing the Lady Nelson motor out of the harbor and just after 7:30 in the evening, and the wind blowing, and the blue sky, and the coolness, and within three sentences of you telling them this, you see those little shutters come down about 1/2 inch behind their eyeballs, where like you know there's like some little like a window has dropped back, and it's still about 1/2 inch of their eyeballs that's still accessible to you, but from there back it's like nobody. Like the glass pane is down, because you when and you know, as soon as you finish, you say they will say, "Oh yeah, I saw that too." Okay. Or yeah, oh yeah, my mother went sailing on the. Is that clear? That whatever is present, there has to be something that meets it because of a fear of maybe. Not being acceptable or not sure what you should do one way or the other, right? Basically, kind of a delusion response. Not actually being able to just hear an experience without somehow thinking that one is supposed to measure up to it or, you know, or guard it off, somehow not let it in unless you can find one that's equal. Does that make sense to you? So those are three types of pride. Because all of them stop you from just being permeable, open, and able to have a new experience. Don't they? Now, isn't that nice to know? So when you see them arise, you don't go jumping on yourself, like, thank you very much. You have a sense of joy. Oh, goody, I can see that cry. Oh, goody. Oh, I never knew that was pride before. Now I can see that that's pride. You can then do the whole kind of work with the Four Foundations of Mindfulness. You can look directly at it and see that it's no self. No inherent identity. It's just like a facade. One of your favorite movie sets, you roll it out and then you roll it away when you don't see it. Don't you? And in fact, it tends to roll out automatically when you don't think you want it. And maybe you want to like have more choices about when the movie set arises. So now that you know it doesn't have, that is not your identity, nor does that have any power except the power of habituation. Now you can decide when you find it rolling out, you can say, on second thought, I'll just see that as thought. And let it dissolve into emptiness. So do you see how working with the Four Foundations of Mindfulness actually helps you during the day become more present and more willing to be actually a living human being. Do you understand that? It would be nice. I think to myself many times, I would like to have about 5 minutes in my whole life when I'm actually alive. Not in the past and not in the future. I figure I've probably got about 3.5 minutes so far. Collecting. According to the Buddha, it only took one day to attain enlightenment. One day of awareness. So how many minutes have you collected? You know? One day. That gives you enough power to actually be able to understand things as they are and have compassionate, non-clinging awareness. I think that sounds like the kind of career choice I'd be interested in, you know? I like the sound of the fringe benefits and unraveling at the end of moving in space, waves and ripples, you know, fringe benefits. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato. Thanks for the desk. Whoever gave me a desk, I appreciate it. So you have these four sides to the stupa. Earth is in front. Earth consciousness, when it manifests in form, uses material in different wave frequencies, densities, or finenesses, like long waves or very short waves, right? To four different functions. So it's very like a light coming through a prism and breaking into the colors. Does that make sense to you? Consciousness coming into form and then manifesting, which is why it's called a rainbow body. Which is why you talk about a rainbow body, because when you understand how it is consciousness interacting with the elements, you have actually a clear comprehension of what is mind body, and you're able to use them like light, the five different qualities that consciousness breaks into, which are called the five aggregates in Buddhism. When those five aggregates are actually purified so that you're seeing them as not self, subject to dissatisfactoriness and impermanence, and are aware of the peacefulness of not clinging to them, which are called the four great signs in Buddhism, usually translated as anicca, dukkha, anatta, and nibbana. Anicca, impermanence; dukkha, dissatisfactoriness; anatta, no inherent identity; nibbana, peace. That when you have a clear understanding of those signs, then the five aggregates become what are called the five Dhyani Buddhas. Is that clear to you? I know. Is that theoretically clear to you? If any of you don't know what an aggregate is, or a Dhyani Buddha or something, I'm assuming you're going to say, like Cecily, could you speak in Tasmanian, please? Like, what is an aggregate? Oh, pardon me? About what one? The aggregate? According to Shakyamuni Buddha, there are five ways to describe the experience of mind-body, the experience of life, unless, of course, you do it three ways. The three ways are mind, citta, body, rupa, and the different energies called the mind states that are the interaction between the two, called cetasika. So one way of describing a mind-body is body, speech, and mind. Or Chita, Chaitasika, Rupa. And there is one whole way of exploring Buddha Dharma, including meditations and so forth, that is based totally on Chita, Chaitasika, Rupa. Some people like to qualify that as the higher teaching and call it the Abhidhamma, because the Abhidhamma, which is a particular aspect of the Buddhist canon, which, by the way, was written after the time of the Buddha, which most people who are Abhidhamma scholars somehow just usually neglect to mention, is based on citta, cittasika, rupa. Mind, body, and the energy flows between the two, basically. In the Tibetan, you have Abhidhamma, but you also have in all of the deity yoga, Om, rupa. This is the brain that runs the body. Ah, chitasika, emotion, feeling. This is the motive center, that which is the flow of energy between body and mind, between mind and mind, between emotion and emotion, you know, every possible wave and ripple, all the motive. This is the motivational brain. And chitta, which is home, om, ah, home. This is usually white om at the forehead, right? But the brain runs the body. This is the center that runs all motives and emotions. Ah. This is the center actually that runs all that, because, you know, the result, and I'm going to just seem to wander a bit, but it seems important to me to tell you this, so I'm going to do it, and if it's not useful, just ignore it, and I'll get back on your question in a second. This is called perception. This is the power of perception. Perception, whenever there is a view, there is an emotion that is supporting that view. Whenever there is an emotion, there is a view that gives the form or gives the form. You know, no form, no way of directing energy, right? So this is the energy, and this is the direction it's going to go. So perception is basically taking emotion, and this is the way one usually uses it. But with perception, when you actually begin to play with it, you begin to understand that you can change your perception, that your perception changes all the time, and that you personally can change your perception. So when you change your perception, then both these two change. So I was talking about that the other day. I was saying, in fact, if you want to really understand a lot of Buddhism, just look at what it does with perception. That's the main focus. The main focus of meditation is how you perceive. When you actually perceive, that your perception is how you balance yourself. You can feel when you're perceiving too much trying for something, you know. It's a very specific feeling, isn't it? It's kind of straining, and there's this actual feeling like you should be trying. And the problem with becoming is it just feeds itself, doesn't it? And you keep thinking, one more bite, I've almost got it. I've almost got it, one more. Like the crow. Good. I'll tell you the story of the crow later. It's such a good story, I have to tell. So, to be able to perceive perception, it's neat to actually see, oh, that's a thought, and there's a feeling attached to it. And then you decide, would I like to use that feeling some other way? Would I like to use it for compassion, think, well, everybody has this feeling? Or am I happy in my own little box doing my own little movie, and I don't want anybody else to be real in my existence? How generous do I feel? Am I the queen of the universe this morning, living all by myself in my own virtual reality? Or would I allow that maybe somebody else is also queen of the universe? You know, just briefly. Just okay, you can be queen of the universe for about 2 seconds here, but I'm taking it back right away. How are you? Whoops, okay, that's it. You know, actually open your heart to somebody else doing the same way. That's the power of this one. This one can actually, this is like the one that can swing how you see it. It's the most accessible. It's interest. So like when you're doing meditation, there's going to be a lot of emotion comes up, and how you perceive that emotion, whether it's the Theravada practice, whether it's Zen, whether it's Chinese Mahayana, whether it's Vajrayana that appears in Japan or in Tibet, doesn't matter, it is still based on how you use perception. Is that interesting? I find that really interesting. And in Christianity, it is the same. They use slightly different words, but your faith, isn't it? They say what you choose to perceive. In a certain way, you can see. I think a lot of the rest of the instruction in Christianity isn't as clear as it is in Buddhism, which is why, for me, Buddhism was a more interesting choice. It really was like a choice at a certain point. Okay, I'm obviously somebody who's very involved with religion. What is it? Which religion do I see as the most direct, least complicated? You know? Oh, Buddhism. Okay. So then the other way of perceiving a mind-body is thought. That is to say, when consciousness comes into form, comes into manifestation, there needs to be form. And with form, there is also feeling. I like, I dislike, physical, I like, I dislike, I'm satisfied, I'm unsatisfied, neutral, mental. Five feelings, usually, basically. It's actually two more, but they're not usually introduced. And then, next one is called perception, our good old buddy. And the next one is called propensities, which is kind of like, sometimes it used to be always translated mental formations. There isn't a satisfactory way. Closed is archetype. But most people don't understand what the word, what Jung meant by archetype anyway, so that's basically useless for communication. But, you know, when I was in Israel, we were all playing around in the Dead Sea, and quite interesting, where we were trying to think each other. And I'd all sit on somebody, and we'd all roll off and laugh hysterically, and our eyes would burn from the brine. And then we finished doing that, and I could still sort of see I hadn't blinded myself or kind of blinking my eyes. I liked the way everything is kind of, you know, like, I don't know if you've had really brighty. You know, when you get something in your eye and it's like soot or something, and you get that kind of, almost like a glaze. So everything is, all the edges shift and everything, you know, it's that feeling, all you know. So I'm looking and I'm kind of liking that, and the sun is like very bright, you know, and it's, and these dead sea, the waves are like that, you know, they go. And I'm watching the water, and you know, I like tripping out, so I'm having a really good time. Oh, this is really great. Then my eyes start to clear, and I look a little closer, and I can see under the surface of the water. It is so concentrated, because it was a salt ocean that was cut off, and it's been sitting in the desert for years. So it's like so concentrated, a brine, that when you look in with that clear, 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 powerful light, you could see crystals almost forming, and then a wave comes and they break up, and then it almost forms here, and then a wave comes and it breaks up. That's like propensity, the tendency to do this with your life, the tendency. And you can feel them in you, can't you?
Yes.
When you're not sure what you're going to do, oh, maybe I'll. Oh, maybe. So that's what that one is. Interesting, huh? I don't know a word. But propensity is close, I think, if you have an image like a Dead Sea behind it, or you know what an archetype is. Is that useful? And then the last one is consciousness, but it's vijnana consciousness, and there's these different words for mind or consciousness in Buddhism that we don't have in English. We're really good at naming emotions in English, but we don't have very many different words for consciousness. So these five, you know, form is, the consort of form is space. So that aspect of consciousness that is going to be responsible for ignoring everything else is basically form is ignorance. Remember me talking about the shrine, about, you know, why you put your books on a table or something, is because what you're going to do is you're going to focus on. So you're taking it out of totality. So you can ignore everything else. You lift an area and then you can focus on it. You're ignoring. Your power of ignorance gives you form. Remember me talking about that? Remember me getting you to do that really tricky, tricky physical exercise where I had you all do this? Or, if you wished, you could have done. You remember that? I said you were supposed to do it when I said now, and you all had to go. Or, if you wanted to, you could go. Right? Remember? And then I said when you finish doing that, I'll ask you a question, and you all answer it once. Some of you didn't believe me, so we had to do the exercise more than once. So, now, what did you see? What didn't you see? Did you not see more than you saw? Now, what did you see? What didn't you see? Did you not see more than you saw? Your eyes picked up just as many impressions, didn't they? Some part of you said, no, 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 that. No, 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 that. Dismiss, 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 that. Dismiss. So that's the power of ignorance. You wouldn't be able to go shopping if you couldn't ignore. You wouldn't be able to read a book. You wouldn't be able to dress yourself. You wouldn't be able to love somebody. You wouldn't be able to smell a rose. You wouldn't be able to do anything in your life if there wasn't ignorance. If you did not have the power of ignorance. It's when it's working without your choice that there's a few little difficulties. Oh, that was a curb! Imagine my surprise. The curbs of life, you know, that we trip over because of ignorance as well. So it's really a power, isn't it? It's a beautiful power. So form, the consort, is state. Ignorance uses space, doesn't it? Creates a space or brings form in. The concert of form is space. The concert of feeling is earth. How do you choose to accumulate things? By liking or disliking. Concert of perception. It's fire. Oh, I'm going to burn with that. Oh, I'm just going to cool off of that. The concept of mental formation is air. And the consort of consciousness is water. Expecting. Freezing, get pissed off if things aren't just right. Like the container of everything is just dirt. Isn't it true? Don't we just hate an idea that we haven't already thought of? If we're comfortable. Like that somebody else could also be driving on the road in front of us. Call it road rage. You could call it water. You could call it the great Jnani Buddha of Shobhya visiting you. Anytime there is anger, you say, oh, welcome, great wisdom Buddha of Shobhya. Every time there's perception, you know, passion and not wanting, you know, like that whole passion perception thing, you could say, oh, the great Jnani Buddha Amitabha, welcome. Every time there's like like and dislike, you could say, oh, the great Jnani Buddha Ratnasambhava, welcome. Every time there's ignorance, oh, the great Jnani Buddha Varochana, welcome. Thank you for gracing me. How can I use your visitation for the benefit of all beings? What? Every time this mental formation, those propensities to see that, oh, the great Gyani Buddha, Moga Siddhi, welcome. It's a sketch, and it's a lifetime of exploring. It's a sketch. Maybe that will give you, save you a little confusion. I would have liked to have known that when I started. That clearly. So here it is. See, this is consciousness manifesting in form. And this side is earth, this side is water, the back side is fire, the other side is air. It's manifesting in space. This part here is called the lion throne base. This is like where you're learning lifetime after lifetime. Wait a minute. What do we got here? This is where you're learning lifetime after lifetime. That it actually is better to be altruistic than not. Actually, are more satisfied by sharing a meal than by picking out and kicking everybody else out into blizzards. The sense of richness increases through a real experience of sharing. That's a beautiful word. So that's this, it takes lifetime in Buddhist terms. You know, how billions and billions and billions and billions and billions and billions and billions of moments of consciousness support us. Billions of trial and error, billions of moments of history of ancestors beyond the imagination are the ground on which we have this, just this moment, just this opportunity. And out of all the generosity of all that, all of the times of learning slowly, slowly that altruism is better, we have this moment just for you to honor that and to see whether we can see beyond that slightly passive. Or if it was said, if I appear so great, it's because I feel that the shoulders is better. Everyone else. Everyone knows that's true, isn't it? How much your life is not only yours, it's the result of billions and billions and billions of moments. So that's the one. Lion throne here. No lion's throne without that thing. That's called sila. It's called morality. There is no way to balance self-grasping without morality. Because there is such a strong sense of an inherent self. Part of ignorance is being able to feel as if I exist as real. It's true? Don't you all secretly feel just like I do? I know I popped out of my mother's womb knowing exactly what I know at this moment. I've always known it. Anyone ever said that? Oh, I've always known it. Anyone ever, those words ever passed anyone's lips in this room? Oh, I always felt that way. Not. What a lie. It's a lie. But there is something that is telling the truth when it says that, isn't there? Can you feel that? There is something that actually believes that there is this I that has been rolling through all time and space, all eternity, like a stainless steel ball bearing, untouched. And if that were true, there'd be no hope. It would just be the same Dan, same as Theo Paul. If that were true, it's only because that isn't true that there is a difference. But that is the hardest thing, to allow yourself to see this. We'll do it in little patches. Does that make sense to you? So unless you have actually done a lot of practice of sila and taught yourself how good it is to think of others, you don't have a hope in heaven, hell, or earth of getting past that ignorance. Because your own desires are going to justify every moment. Only kindness gives you the power to move beyond those traps when you're caught in abuse. Only kindness. Earth is also, when it's fully developed, the power of loving kindness. And with that kindness, you need compassion, which means the space to see skillful possibilities. If you ever see outside of yourself, and then you have to have the space to see skillful possibilities, right? Which is what peacefulness is. Real peacefulness is not just focusing on the fly, but being aware of the windshield and what else might be possible. Does that make sense, Keith? So this here is a little half step. Sometimes it's a circle. Whoops. Sometimes it's a little square. That represents, that's the capstone for all of this. This is like this little sandwich of learning how. Oh, I've got a pointer.
Yes.
From here to here.
This is good.
This is very useful, thank you. And this is like the lines are on base. And it's like, you know, you can see how it's kind of enclosed within itself in a certain way. I've never been taught that or seen it anywhere, but to me that represents exactly that it takes lifetimes. It's billions and billions and billions of moments before one really, truly, deeply understands that all truism is the only way. So this goes back and forth on itself over and over and over until there is this moment here, which is the capstone for the lion throne. Now it's complete, which is called the 10 marks of sila. And if you are actually going to become a spiritual person, in every lifetime you have to hit the despair of selfishness and realize it is only by caring more for an other than for oneself. You have to hit the despair of knowing that there is nothing you have that's valuable. All your ideas, all your desires are like there's so much dust in the circle of lifetime. That 95% of the species that have lived in this planet are extinct, and most of them live a lot longer than humans have so far. You have to hint that and both feel the relief of it and the sense of, well then, what are we doing? When did the Buddha leave his little happy little throne with his harem and his like science teachers and his like, you know, astrology box and they could sit around and watch the stars and discuss things and, you know, eat you know, excellent lassi all day and you know, just have courage to knock your socks off, you know, whatever he wanted. When did he actually leave? When he had been out and he'd seen that there was old age, that there was sickness, and there was death. Those are the four messengers which he had been shielded from all his life. And then he saw a monk Then he came back home, and his wife and his son, his newborn son, were sleeping. They don't say this in the text, because they were written by a bunch of men, you know, and you know how men are prone to things like sex and midlife crises, whereas women are blessed with menopause. So men get caught in that, you know, biological urge, you know, like desire, don't they? Come on, get real, don't they? You betcha, don't they? Absolutely. It's hard. It's hard to be male. I salute you. I just think that's incredible being a male. I'm like, I got news for you, female. Especially now that it's okay to think if you're female. It was a little harder culturally for a long time, but you know, now that you're allowed to, I mean, I just sit here and go blah, 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 and you guys actually listen. And I'm, you know. You know? I'm a walking womb. Was. So what does the Buddha do? You know, like you know, according to most of the teachings you see, he goes home after seeing a monk and he sees his wife and daughter, and I have even had one teacher say that they were drunk and sleeping and drool was running out of the wife's mouth and he got disgusted with it. But like that's very much from a male point of view, isn't it? How you have to teach yourself not to get caught, like take the power of that energy. You have to take the power of the instinctual energy of the four elements, but not get caught in trying to make it for I. Right? Don't you? I think so. You have to do that whether you're male or female. Female is just a tad easier. Now, it's not easy when you're doing that monthly thing, you know, and especially when it starts to run down and you start, you know, oh, just one more baby, you know. Oh, quick, produce one more, you know, genetic match here. Oh, there looks funny. Oh, you look like a good gene pool. Hi, could you help me fix my flat tire? And it has nothing to do with what your brain's doing, or does it? Come on, lady. You'll find yourself doing things that are like totally the opposite when you're fertile, right? And you're going like, who's in charge? Imagine not being able to lose that when you're 40, 50, 60. Can you imagine it? Keep going, oh my God. The joy of actually discovering it when I'm riding the bus. What was that? That was a really different thought. What was that? Scuttle, grab the thought, etc. That's how I used to think before puberty. Wow! I got my brain back. Oh. Yes! I'm sorry, I shouldn't be going on and on about this. We'll stop now. But it was such a joy. I can look at things. It was so nice. Anyway, okay. So when you know, when the Buddha came back there, I swear, just looking at it with my brain, that he must have looked at who he loved, having seen old age, sickness, and death. Who he loved. You know, I have never yet met a man who did not love his children. Or his wife. Or whatever, whoever his main partner was. He looked at them and he suddenly realized he had nothing to give them. That's the only way you have the power. That's the only way. You cannot do it out of disgust. You cannot do it for yourself. The only way you can break past that lion's own base, doing it for the next generation, is to know that there is nothing you have that you can give, whatever you can give, and it is the practice, but it has to be not for yourself. Because if it's for yourself, you don't have the power to break through the ignorance. There is no practice greater than altruism. There is no practice greater than bodhicitta. Literally, there is no practice, because for a human to actually make any kind of meaningful little impression of the non-permanence of an inherent self, there has to be a power of emotion stronger towards something outside. It has to be guru devotion, it has to be, you know, whatever. Devotion to Dharma, there has to be has to be something. Thank you for keeping me honest. There has to be something that is more powerful. Now this is really interesting, isn't it? So there it is. That's the 10 marks of Sila. That's the capstone. Here is the four foundations of mindfulness. First one we've already talked about, awareness of the body. We've done a little practice of that. Do you have any questions? I'm just going to review four foundations of mindfulness, but I want to make sure you understand. And this is actually what you actually look like. This is actually where you live. At the moment, however, you're kind of living, you know, in sort of the cloakroom. And how to actually access the whole. Those steps, up to you. You do either one. Often in the Tibetan stupas, they have the stairs going up the stupa, a central path that is slightly different level of stairs, slightly smaller and direct, and the middle, which is like where the, you know, people like the Holiness, the Dalai Lama, people like those are the stairs they use, everybody else uses the other one. And also represents the truth that you can go lifetime after lifetime, the three uncountable eons that a Buddha took to awaken. If you're interested in some of some Buddha stuff, or you can go the direct path if you're interested in Arahat and, you know, some of the, I just want to get there, and then after I'm there, I'm going to start, you know, doing some of the Bodhisattva work. Is that clear? As much? Or clear? That's sort of Buddhist stuff I was talking more, you know, that's more like when you're going to send postcards home, not even how you need to travel agent. Questions, answers, comments, or complaints? Yes, Anne?
Yeah, I'm
just saying
your comment that...
Menopause?
No.
Oh, no.
Sorry.
Everything is done for the sake of self? Developing generosity is very important for yourself. Mm-hmm. Once you have practiced generosity enough, you begin to realize that there is a reality that we're outside of you. You know, see, these people are really there too. And then there begins to be a need for skill in generosity, which is called compassion. That you're actually, that space opens up more. The ignorance is less strong. So like ignorance is in the embrace of the concept of space. When space becomes more real, you can see. When the ignorance is more real, you can't even see your consort, right? We all know that. And when you actually become more aware of the consort, the ignorance is less strong, and there becomes a real desire to know more about others. Right? As that develops more and more, then there is a real interest in being skillful in generosity of there. So generosity naturally leads to compassion. Kindness, naturally, the practice of kindness naturally leads to compassion. They are not the same thing. You know, when in doubt, it's better to practice generosity because it's you who's in doubt, so you're the one who needs to be generous. And when you feel like it's not a good idea to give, then be generous, kind to yourself. Loving kindness always has to begin with yourself. You cannot give what you don't experience. You cannot give what you don't have. So, you try to come first towards yourself. And we do it in a very pragmatic way. May I be where I'm happy. Very, very pragmatic. Now, here, where I am, here, and now, may I be there. Now, may I get rid of all you bastards so I'd probably be happy because it's your problem. But in this state, here and now, may I be happy. And when you do that enough, after a while, you actually start to change your perception so you can see the little moments of happiness that are expected. In the here and now. Then you can start thinking, yeah, and if I can feel that, I wish everybody around me could feel that. It's a slow connection. And again, that's good. And if your sense of self or your own purpose is stronger than your awareness of others, you're not going to have the power to move up. And how do you get that? By practicing kindness. First to yourself, giving yourself kindness in the moment, actual kindness, where you actually are. If you're tired, eat. If you're hungry, eat. If you're lonely, rub your feet and say, be with yourself. Don't go away. Stay home. See yourself as a lover. It works, doesn't it? And then, of course, when you've done that, you know how nice it is. So you see somebody you kind of like to sort of throw them a smile or something. They could be a lover too. There's a lot of times there's no way you can go past loving kindness and compassion. They just feed each other, right hand, left hand is saying anything. And then his right hand is loving kindness, his left hand is compassion. And then these two hands is sympathetic joy and that's like coming in. That's like guiding the inner jewel or opening the inner jewel. It's how you work in the outer, it's how you work in the inner. Any other questions, answers, comments, concerns? Yes.
You spoke about the counter tails and then the red top and then the top.
Yeah. Countless eons. It takes countless eons to have the power to develop altruism. When you have developed that sense of altruism, however fleetingly, you can build on it just by, if there is enough there, however fleetingly, you can actually establish a basis. You don't have to build it to the point of in Buddha's great Sama Sambuddhasas, they spend 3 eons doing hearing, which is why they have such huge earlobes. See his earlobes dangling around his shoulders there? God, he's not just disgusting. Get little ear grease on his shirt. That's from 3 eons, 3 countless eons. Eon is a eon in that language is a kalpa. A kalpa is coming into being, existing, and passing away of world systems. 7 times is 1 kalpa. Does this give you an idea? Not the planet, but the world system, or solar system, and a galaxy, cluster of galaxies coming into being and passing away 7 times would be 1 kalpa. So 3 kalpas. From when Dipankara, supposedly the previous Buddha, I can't remember, but I'm told, that's what I heard. I don't exactly remember Shakyamuni Buddha either, however, have read about this, and I'm assuming it's true. realize this is all hearsay on my part? Hearsay? Do you hear something on this planet? So he's got these long earlobes because it took him 3 long kalpas of practicing sila, practicing generosity, developing the ability to hear beyond himself. When the lifetime, when he was born, that had been established, but it had to be triggered, activated in his life. That's what a Buddha does. Like, all that potential is there in all of us, but we haven't probably created the consciousness that gives it the form to make a powerful leap. Meditation is basically the tool to do that. Now, you are either going to be able to make that leap by having enough awareness of sila to at least get to the first step. If you get to the first step, and if you practice well, and if you have very good fortune, and the seeds of karma, propensities ripening in this life just for this moment, are more towards the wholesome than unwholesome, just before you go crazy, you'll suddenly have a clear insight into Anicca, Dukkha, Anatta, and Shunyata from just doing the first step, the 4 foundations of mindfulness. That can lead you right up to an experience of the talk. But then that you won't have this power of Sammasambuddhasa, of appearing anywhere, anytime, any place, no longer subject to birth, is how the Buddha described it. No longer subject to birth and rebirth. No longer subject, ability to consciousness to dance universally throughout time and space. It's the self that stops, the fixed, small, ignorant holding of the self, that the consciousness does not lose the power of perception or of selfing. So it's a universal consciousness now. The universe with the awareness of a Dhyan or without problem. One of the Buddha's main expressions that I just think is one of the greatest one-liners of all time is, I see these concepts, but I'm not fooled by them. Sounds like a good idea. Myself, I usually believe all the concepts that come rolling out of my mind. Isn't that beautiful? I believe that. But I'm not fooled. So if you're going to do that, or if you have already gone up to there and then chosen rebirth, no longer subject, but for the benefit of compassion for all beings, chosen to come back over and over and hear the story over and over, or come back as a tofu, or blah, 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 then you can go up and down this quite easily. There's a sort of a middle step. That movie is sort of telling us the Dalai Lama, for example, will go up the steps. And the center steps are stupid, but everybody else wants to do that. You have no attained, when you have that experience, and you have experience of Arahat, you've certainly gone past the 7 factors of enlightenment and the Eightfold Path, but you haven't necessarily got all these different attainments of the knowledge and wisdom of a perfectly fully awakened being, and so therefore can manifest anywhere at any time, blah, 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 blah. Zapti here is cause. This is all the causes. This is what these are like the actions one can perform to create the result. This is the result. This is cause to here, and this is result to here. Up to here is all of the causes required for success in what they call the holy or the unholy. I love that in the Theravada tradition. Holy or unholy life. That means for worldly success or for supra mundane success. These stages this is the great how-to, you know. This is like success for dummies and whatever it is you want to do. You know, success for dummies 101. You know those dummies books? This is success for dummies 101 and anything you wish to attempt. You know, play the stock market, get a partner, buy a yacht, whatever. But from here up, it's like for the super Monday. From here, it's the end of cause and the success. It was fun. Like quite the video. How are you today? That's a very nice shirt. Mm-hmm. I understand you live on the other side of the island. This is great. You should have a good weekend. Power! Dangerous, ain't that? I'll put it down. Any other questions, answers, comments, or complaints? Who have I got? Herbert? Okay. Please. Could you just say a little bit more? Oh, can you go to hell forever and ever? That's a reasonable question. Yeah, I mean, certainly, a rebirth is causal. So, you know, cause and effect is one of the most basic parts of the Buddhist teaching, that the result of a wholesome action is wholesomeness, the result of an unwholesome action is unwholesomeness. And that's what you're learning in this time. You know, you're learning that if you lie, you expect everybody to be lying to you. It's true, isn't it? If you rob, steal, and cheat, you're always suspicious. You always have to spend all your money on lots. And, you know, when Hell's Angels buy it, there's the motorcycle gang, kind of like motorcycle gang. Are they here? Yeah. So they always buy a house in a very nice neighborhood, and everybody in the neighborhood is always glad that they live there because, you know, you don't have to worry about crime or anything in the neighborhood. But when they build a house, it is like a fortress. Like it's steel walls, anti-bomb, you know, blah, 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 blah. Like entering. Yeah. And it, to me, is exactly an analogy. When you live a certain way, you are encumbered by that way. If you want more freedom, more ability to move in and out, more permeability in your life, of course, you become nicer and nicer. Just because it pays off. All things are done for the sake of self, which is wonderful. Like and dislike are very important parts, you know, feeling. One of the five. That's earth and feeling. And that's basically how we learn to fear. You know? If you always do the negative, pretty soon, you know, you end up looking up your own asshole, you know, because you end up going into more and more shit. Don't you? More lying, pretty soon everybody's lying to you, pretty soon nobody trusts you, pretty soon whenever you say anything, everybody goes, oh yeah. True? When you steal, and the prices of everything goes up, it ruins the whole neighborhood. The whole area becomes caught in that. So eventually, and then you don't like living there. So eventually, after enough lifetimes, eventually all of us get it. In Buddhism, the teaching is that everybody will awaken, because there's not, you know, it's the only option. It's like all seeds will grow toward the light. Some point or other, some seeds grow better at night, some grow better in the daytime, you know, but eventually all seeds are going to go to the same place. How that eventually will wind out is another story. How long that will take. You know, all beings desire pleasure. That's one of the statements again in Buddhism. All beings desire pleasure. It takes a long time before all beings realize that the greatest pleasure is to practice altruism. So that learning process within the lifetimes of learning it doesn't have any time, because any more than really, if you are sitting here with me right now, the sense of the whole last week doesn't really have any time in a certain way, does it? There are events and who did what to who and where it is went and whether you need to get more milk or, you know? They're like a whole bunch of stringing little experiences. But there, and there's a continuum of experiences, but there isn't any actual sense of, you know, this is how much time it took for this week. Is there? Not in my experience either. And in Buddhism they say that, you know, more often when beings die, they don't know they died. It's just business as usual, you know. Business as usual during alteration. And that beings in hell don't know they're in hell. It's just business as usual. Or beings in animal realms don't know they're in hell. It's just like, it feels like me. And I'm sure my experiences of the going from living in a nice, wonderful, lower middle class family with parents that were truly wonderful to living on the streets a few years later, and all of the things, I don't recall exactly which point. Oh, was this that happened or that, you know. It was just business as usual, and like going there and, you know, getting fairly low down and then deciding, well, maybe it wasn't really, it was, you know, it was very good for a Scorpio to do something so intense, but could, maybe there might be a better career choice for me after all, you know. Loving drama as I do and did. And it took a while for that to sink in, but, you know, and then working your way out of that, you know, and every bit of that was, so there wasn't one great, there were great moments here and there, but they were the accumulation of many small moments with nothing in particular. Does that make sense to you? So all those little moments are probably the most important thing, which is why the habit of our daily life is where Buddhism puts the focus. Everyday sit, because it is the habitual that creates rebirth. And rebirth happens in every moment. And if you actually decide that you would like to have a choice about how you're reborn, and you pay attention to consciousness, it's not a fear, it's like, oh yeah. Okay. Oh yeah, this is what I want to buy. Oh, this is my life, this is, you know, this is what I want to buy with. I like it to become more this, more this, more this. So it isn't that there aren't hell states, it's that A, half the time beings in hell aren't quite aware that it's hell, that it just feels like what they're already doing, and it requires a real, if you actually realize it's hell, that being you realize that this is painful and I don't want to do it anymore, then the next thing that's required is to see the possibility of doing something else. As soon as you see that possibility, you do it. So all these states are, however long you might wander around in them, all of these states are subject to your clear perception of seeing them as they are and deciding how you do want them. I think often in Buddhism is kind of like pulling yourself up by your own bootstraps. You remember that expression? Is that, am I anywhere near asking your question? And? Yeah.
You talked about the Buddha said when he's traveling through his life and trials,
nothing to give them. I mean, they have money and all that stuff, but there was death, old age. Yeah. Mind you, they were very well cared for.
Yeah, I understand.
That there was no question at all of their health or their care. They had, also you must understand that Yeah, and that is a real issue, and that is what you have to do. You have to decide whether your staying in the circumstance you're in is a dream, or whether you want to do something out of love that is like quite, you know, are you just going to continue even though you know you have nothing to give, or is that sense that there must be something I can give, that you want to find something other than just drifting on. It is sometimes absolutely essential to walk away from what has been satisfactory because it leaves something unfulfilled. And when you leave something like that, you're leaving it out of love, not because you can't tolerate it. The only true renunciation is when your belly is full and there is something more that you feel is required to see. Renunciation is not renunciation if you really don't like sex anymore. Is it? So, you know, the real act of renunciation is to realize that one could continue and that there is this very strong thing. And in fact, that was such a, when the Buddha finally awakened, which took another 6 odd years, or maybe they were even years, or maybe they weren't odd at all. I don't know. But, when he's sitting under the tree, and one of and there are these four states of temptation that come, like very similar to Christ in the wilderness, the last one, the one that, you know, is all pulling out all the stops and like, okay, this is really going to test you, is okay, yeah, but you know, your father is getting old, and your wife and your son, and you know, you should actually, you know, yeah, you could awaken and you can be good, but you should actually care for them too. And he often said the greatest obstacle I can recall three places in the sutra, reading three times in the sutras where the Buddha is purported to have said, the greatest challenge to overcome is the desire for companionship and the desire to be interwoven with community, which is exactly what your point is. And what is his role, what is the onus of his existence in that relationship? In relationship. And relationship is the most difficult thing for humans to actually renounce. And you can't renounce it unless you feel like you've given everything you can. And that if you stay, you might not be able to give something that's more precious than you've been able to give so far. You have to renounce true love. That's very hard to do. So I'm not negating what you're saying, I'm just saying it takes it to another level. And you know, I don't know how many of us are willing to go there. I know when I placed my daughter for adoption, because it just was so clear to me that I was incapable of loving her well in actual life, that the intensity of my bitterness and self-hatred was profound. And I think that, you know, one of the greatest things that you have to watch for when you, if you turn away in renunciation like that, is the kickback of your own remorse. It's very important, and so that the rules arose in how, when one could join the Sangha. First of all, you had to be 8 years old before you could join. And you had to have actually had some time with your parents. You know? Second of all, if you were married or you had a family or parents or anything like that, you had to have everybody's permission. Everybody had to say, yeah, this is a really good idea. It's interesting, isn't it? Thirdly, you couldn't owe anything. All your debts had to be paid. And those rules all came about in when other people wanted to leave their parents and leave their children. And it became very clear, no, this is too much suffering. A, because the people themselves could not do the work, because they would be struck by remorse or going You're running around banging your heads against trees instead of sitting under them and meditating, you know, heart of the trees. And... Oh, he had lots of that. He had a grandfather and major courtiers and teachers. And he really did. I mean, that wouldn't, in the Buddha's case, I mean, that, yeah, certainly he knew, and knowing who his father was, but the Buddha came back when Rahulan was six. Rahulan was his son. Rahulan was six, came back, you know, after he awakened, one of the first things he did was run back to the throne and say, hi, I'm back. I got something for you. How are you doing? No, he just left when they were sleeping. And so these rules came afterwards. It's a hard one, isn't it? Only if it is a true renunciation, only if it is an act of absolute love, would that be allowable. With allowable in terms of the morality of being able to bear the consequences. Allowable within oneself, I mean. It would not have the power to attain Samasambuddhata if that were done for anything except total love. And that's what I'm saying about Sila. And that's why I'm saying I cannot imagine him doing it the way it's often described to me, out of disgust for family life or anything like that, which you know has been described to me from him. Like totally impossible for me to believe that awakening would be possible on such based on such a motive, because that is too deeply into conceit and what that would result in a really good kind of schizophrenic state where you would think you were awakened and you might get a few followers. You certainly have charisma, you know, shine in the dark and all that stuff. It's a limited value. There's only so many times you can do that at a cocktail party before people are impressed anymore. So, you know, desperate people are who come around and are appreciating it. So. But a real attainment requires real love. And so from the point of view of someone who feels an obligation, it's not love. Or whatever reason I have in my background to feel abandoned. So when I see it out there, it looks like abandonment to me. That's still not love. That's like a sense of unfairness or lack of justice. So if you did it or I did it, it would have different consequences. I don't think I would become a Buddha. I don't know about you, but I know I the likelihood is I'd be one of those people at cocktail parties. Trying to wow you with my expertise at bending forks. Whole hung. Hobart's a small town. I'd probably run out of audience. It's pretty crazy. Will that satisfy you? My non-answer satisfy you for the moment?
It does from the Buddhist perspective. If a person knew what went there, surely you might.
Oh, there was lots of judgment on him.
Yeah,
oh boy, there was danger. Which is amazing that he went back.
Yeah.
That's amazing that he went back. Because yeah. That was his purpose. Yeah, that's what he was going. He was going out, you know, he was going on a big hunting trip. And you must understand that nuclear families are a relatively new invention in human psyche. They've only been around for about 500 years. And they started with royalty to protect the bloodline, you know, so the royal right it was God. You do know that. So really, families used to be extended. In an old age home, didn't exist 100 years ago. That's like blink, 100 years is blink. And with any good fortune, they won't exist in 100 years. In any kind of way, we will quit being so impressed with getting something and looking good and start to wonder whether maybe age does have some kind of wisdom. Might be a good idea to have it around our kids. Learn something from me. From somebody who has no purpose whatsoever. I don't know why they're still alive. I wonder how many times I've heard that. I spent a lot of time in old age homes. I recommend, you know, find out where the nearest nursing home is, spend a half an hour there a few times a week, just sit there and imagine yourself looking at yourself. Start to wonder what old age is. I recommend it. It is a profoundly beautiful understanding that we'll get from that. And just watch your devotion. See what a snob you are. I recommend spending half an hour, 3 times a week, sitting in an old age. Just pay attention. This is reality. Nice if there were none, you know? If we could actually grow up with old age. Used to do that. So the whole concept of the man walking away and leaving the woman and the child alone crying and behind closed doors, you know, is like, which is how it is, emotionally, truth of it in our lives, is very new. We haven't had this kind of social, the powers that this nuclear family has given us are profound. So are the problems. Westerners are probably the weakest ego structure of any culture. And the greatest intelligence and grasp, greatest ability to grasp. Conceptually, and in a very brilliant, least confident. I hope I'm turning you on your ear. I love non-answering questions. It's a real knack, I think. You know? I find sometimes I'm a good teacher is because I've managed to not answer questions in a really good way. The person walks away with 20 questions. Like I've been a useful servant to them when I do that. Look at it from another thing. You have a fixed view, look at it from another. Don't be so sure. We have sat here for an hour and a half. You want a break? And then we'll do a little bit of practice. How long a break? 20 minutes? 25 minutes? After that? If you've only done one nice thing in your entire life, just remember it. You're sitting comfortably. You can hold your hands like this. To please me. So I know you have a better way of holding your hands, but just, you know, just humor me, because I'm an old woman, not long, so you want to make sure I have a good rebirth so I don't come back and haunt you for any more of my time. So your left hand is supporting your right hand, and your thumb are just touching, so you're making this kind of oval with your thumbs, like an egg. And you're going to hold that kind of just in front of your water center, which is, of course, 4-finger width or 3 or 2, depending on what you decide about, below your navel, and just in front of your spine. So if you hold it there, then that means there's a little space under your armpit. You notice that? A little space under your armpit. So when your back is fairly straight and your eyes are focused well, you feel what that's like to have that space under your armpits. And then when you feel like a little tired or something, try raising your hands slowly, just a little bit. Just raise them slowly and leave them raised, just a little bit. Or you feel like your mind is way too active, just lower your hands, just really slowly, just a little bit. There are various ways you can move the energy differently in your body when you're sitting. This is one of the ways that very few people seem to have discovered. It's very useful. Another one is just sit slightly more forward from your pelvis. Just sit slightly more forward. Right from your pelvis. Make sure you sit from your pelvis. And watch how that changes the energy. Or just sit slightly more back. Harder to do if you're sitting in a chair, unless of course you're sitting in a chair and not leaning against the back. Niha. So you see, you have like different ways, so you just subtly shift how the flows go through the spine and through the body. Gives you more or less energy at different time, more calm, more excited. Yeah. You won't really feel it until you're actually meditating, until you're actually focusing, and then and you can just play with that a little bit. You'd be surprised how strongly you feel the result. The other thing you do is you put your finger in front of you, say at nose level or lower, and you draw a circle, little circle. When you can see that circle, you just drop your hand. So you're focusing on that circle. Just relax your eyes. Focus on that circle. There's this little circle of space. Okay, now you all know where that circle is. Now just forget about the circle and listen. What does that sound? Really listen. You notice how your eyes just relax when you put your attention to your ears. That's how you hold your eyes. The focus will change and come and go, that's fine. You don't close them, you don't have them open so that you're scary. There are times when you use the eyes to open without blinking or anything, but this is not one of those times. You don't do that, you just put your eyes open. Your chin should be tucked just slightly in, so the back of your head, the neck, the back of your head, and the outside. It's actually a little, almost as straight as you can make it, although it says curve anyway. Not forward, not tip forward, and not straight like you usually have it. But pose just so you have a slight double chin. That's going to give yourself a slight double chin. And you can do this thing with your shoulders. You move your shoulders up, forward and up, forward. As far forward, like you're going to put them in front of your earlobe. Up, and then straight back, and up, still up. So it's the top line of the box. See, forward again. That's the line. Straight back, and then down. That's the back side of the square. Now forward and down. So you're making a square. Got that square? You're drawing a square with your shoulders. Okay, now do it the other way. Feel each point of it. Notice which point you have trouble drawing. It's usually one, right? Pay attention. And then put them up and back. When you get to up and back, stop for a moment. Is that in there? Now just drop them down. Now pull your finger. Now set your eyes. Now put your hands. Now hold your hands up a little bit. Don't rest in your eyes. And think of refuge. Take refuge. Take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the excellent community. Whatever it is you wish to take refuge in. Image of light above your head if you don't have a Buddhist energy. Take refuge in Jesus. Whatever it is that means refuge. Image is best of refuge. think it is for the sake of our being that I wish to be this way. Allow your focus to go on the breath, either way you feel it, in the abdomen moving, or today we're going to give you a choice, where you feel the breath moving from your nostrils. Either one will do. Either one. Where you feel it serving. Or you think you feel it serving. Pretend. Pretend you feel it clearly. And then just be curious, what do you actually do? When the breath is coming in and your abdomen is rising, or you feel the breath on either of your nostrils or both your nostrils when it's coming in, just keep your focus, if you're on the nostril, just at the actual entrance of the nostril, and try to be aware of the movement of the breath past your nostrils. Is it more from the right, more from the left? Don't change it, don't do anything. When it stops, just be aware of that. As the breath comes out, just be aware of that. Is the out-breath longer or shorter than the in-breath, so forth? Can you see a gap between the in-breath and out-breath? Same if you're watching it here at the diaphragm. As it's rising, you just watch that. Is it rising more clear than the falling? Can you see gaps, etc.? Look for a detail of the movement. Allow yourself to play around with the arms as you wish to, if you feel more comfortable letting them down. So you'll probably find...